Sassy Jack Stitchery is sponsoring this week's show with Jamie Chalmers. Sassy Jack's recently introduced Black Swans Studios, a coalition of like-minded needlework artisans created by Kim Young and Jackie DePlessis. Black Swans Studios will focus on sharing collected knowledge and skills with today's needleworkers through multiple learning channels. The first event from the studios will be March 19 to 21 in Asheville, North Carolina. It will feature an impressive museum-quality band sampler from 1747. Registration will open December 15. Learn more and put your name on the contact list at blackswansstudios.com. Sassy Jacks also has the popular Needlework Press 2024 Book of Days available for pre-order. These books sell out quickly, so act now to secure your copy. There's much more going on at Sassy Jacks, and you can keep up with all of it through the Sassy Jacks website, sassyjackstitchery.com, the Jacks Journal newsletter, the Black Swans Studio website, or the Sassy Jacks Facebook page. Put your name on the various lists so you don't miss out on the excitement. Thanks to Sassy Jacks Stitchery for sponsoring this week's show, and now our conversation with Jamie Chalmers. Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Beth Ellicott.
And you're listening to Fiber Talk, the twice weekly podcast for needlework artists. Our artist this week, Mr. X Stitch, Jamie Chalmers. Jamie, welcome.
Thanks for having me, guys. Nice to be here.
All right. So we're going to establish that right out of the gate. It's Mr. X Stitch, not Mr. Cross Stitch.
Yeah. So years of therapy have taught me to be fine about if someone calls me Mr. Cross Stitch. But when I first came up with the name, it was a bit like sort of like a Professor X kind of superhero thing. I was definitely determined to be like, you know, that's why I call myself the kingpin of contemporary embroidery as well. I'm kind of just trying to get Marvel superhero status on the sly, I think.
Well, when you get to that level, let us know, will you?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
And do you get a cape too? That's what I want to know. Do you get a cape?
I mean, my children have asked me not to wear my pants outside my trousers, or in your case, my pants outside my pants, I suppose. But
yeah, you remember when they get to be teenagers, it's even more fun to embarrass them.
Oh my God, I can't wait.
Yeah,
it'll buckle be so up. Much fun.
Yeah, yeah, we both have grown kids, so buckle up. Yeah,
Yeah,
yeah. Mm-hmm. It's not boring.
No, at the moment they think I'm funny. I think my four-year-old rolled her eyes at me the other day, and I was like, oh, God.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. I'm going to see that look a few times.
Yeah. There's the first sign right there.
Yeah. And they learned to perfect it. My daughter recently, when I saw her, she rolled her eyes at me, and I was like, oh, there it is, the eye roll. I got it. I win.
I might keep a chart. I might see if I can, like, you know, how many eye rolls can I get in a week? Like, if I get 25, yeah, I'll give myself a biscuit or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hey, there you go. That's a good idea.
Your odds are high. Yep. Guaranteed. So this is so much fun because, at least, you know, this is a rare instance where we have a guest where there are two males and one female. Because usually it's the other way around. So, two males in the needlework female world outnumbering Beth here. And I'm into this.
We're going 5 hours on this chat.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
And you sent the thing, there was an email when I bought one of your magazines where you talked about how you got started. It was just kind of a thumbing your nose at the female world by buying a stitching kit and just doing it?
Yeah, it was a bit like that. So I was going on a plane to Canada. It was a long haul flight. And I think at the time I was a smoker, so I needed something to entertain myself. And I went into a haberdashery shop and I saw a cross stitch kit. And I just thought it'd be funny because I'm sort of like 6 foot tall. I'm quite large. And I was just like, what will people think if they see me on the plane doing some cross stitch? I just thought it'd sort of freak people out. And that was enough of a sponsoring thought to get me to do it. I mean, I never considered, in fairness, that in a post 9/11 world, freaking people out on a plane wasn't a very smart move, but I persisted nonetheless. And then when I got to Canada and I actually opened the kit and sat down and had a go at it, I kind of fell in love with it. almost straight away, I think, the meditativeness of cross stitch. I think that's the thing. Like, I've, you know, over the years, I've seen a lot of needlework types, but there's something about cross stitch and needlepoint where, because you've got a fabric that's got holes in it, and because you're doing a really simple stitch, it's probably the most meditative of the stitches. And because I realized that when you meditate, if your mind wanders, you're supposed to bring it back to center. Every time you're doing cross stitch and you look at the hole where your needle has to go, you're coming back to center. Mm. So it is like total meditation. And that was the thing, the feeling in my soul was the thing that like made me have a go at it. And the rest was history, really. Thanks very much. I'll see you later.
That's so interesting. So really no exposure prior to that to needlework?
I mean, not massively. No, I remembered a while ago that when I was in middle school, so probably when I was about 10, we did a project on the Bayeux tapestry, and I did some needlework there. Uh-huh. And my mum will claim, hi, mum, if you're listening, that she was an influence on me. She's very sort of knitting and crochet. But it wasn't something that, like, I have a strong tradition of. I mean, I've got quite a small family anyway, and so on my mum's side, both of her parents were dead before I was born, so there wasn't really a tradition there. And so, yeah, I sort of came to it sort of later in life, which I think was quite an interesting, it was an interesting starting point, you know, not necessarily the way most people would start.
Right. Well, but invariably there's some background exposure to needlework of some kind that at least plants the seed, and then later on, you know, it's an opportunity. But it's interesting because we've done several shows on meditation, the meditative aspect of needlework. And yeah, it's a very real thing. Blood pressure goes down, heart rate slows. Yeah, all those things. Yeah.
I absolutely love it. Like, I've taught cross stitch workshops to hundreds, I could even say thousands of people. And the ones that I always enjoy are sort of working with teenagers. I remember doing a school class once of sort of 12-year-olds, and they're all kind of rowdy and, you know, just being themselves, being really vibrant. And then about an hour after I sort of taught them how to stitch and they got going, we had to put the radio on because everybody was silent. Everybody was like in that zone. Mm. And I think it's one of those things, it's really hard to explain to people, but when they try it, they understand like what that feeling is. And for like 50% of the people, quite happily, they get into it. You know, it's a really powerful thing. But it's I find it really hard to try and explain that to people without coming off as a little bit sort of hippy dippy, really.
Yeah, and I just actually I'm reading the Artist Way, and she mentions in like one the first or second chapter using sewing, using stitching as a form of meditation to let your mind go and kind of unsnarl some of those problems. And I just thought that was just interesting. All of a sudden, you know, here it is showing up in you know in a book like that. I found it fascinating.
I've even done, like when I had a real job, I used to do, among other things, like organizational facilitation. So like training with groups and stuff. And even there, I would try and shoehorn a bit of cross stitch in, because I've said it to people before, you know, when you meditate, thoughts come to the surface and you kind of allow them to process. And you can do it, like if you're stitching and you have a piece of paper and a pen next to you, you can almost go, all right, brain, let's get the stuff out of our head. And the stitching occupies part of your brain, like you say, that allows this fluid other half to just let things bubble to the surface. And if there's something that's bugging you, you know, it's almost like you can try and process it while you're stitching. I've found it a very effective technique for that kind of thing.
Right.
Yeah, it works. It works. Yep. Yeah, you can just get lost. Yeah, that's just, you know, I'm sure that all of us have had instances, you know, even if there's something on TV that you're listening to or watching, and pretty soon that even gets tuned out, and you just, into a zone.
Well, the inverse of that, though, is we've been enjoying watching the TV show My Brilliant Friend, which is based on the books by Elena Ferranti, and it's fantastic, but it's in Italian, and there's subtitles, which means you either don't stitch or you miss the whole thing completely.
Subtitles and stitching don't work. Nope.
It's not gonna work, is it?
No.
So one, you know, this one project, it's interesting to me because it's, you know, in the greater view, it's women's work, you know, it's you know, why is a male doing that? And And I've stitched in public before, but I'm still really self-conscious about it. But never bothered you, huh?
It bothered me at first, but I think in some ways it's almost like I kind of went for it anyway. So another example of this in a way was when my wife and I first got together, we did ballroom dancing lessons, and I'm a dreadful dancer, but the discomfort of learning to ballroom was almost worth it, because when you're in that position of discomfort, you know, it's not life threatening or anything, but I think you grow as a person. And I think this was the thing, you know, so I kind of make a joke of it, but I would sit on trains and cross stitch. And so you get this multiplier effect in the UK where people on trains don't talk to each other in the UK, let alone a man who's sitting across the way stitching from you. You know, it's almost like it's this double whammy. And there was an occasion once as well where I was sitting on a train doing some cross stitch. And the thing is, I used to just love to do that because it's a much more effective use of time. You know, I may as well make something while I'm traveling. But I remember these bunch of guys sat down next to me, and I think they were sort of football fans. We were all getting on at the same station in London. And they'd obviously had a good time, and I was sort of sitting there stitching and just being like, okay, keep cool, because these guys could just, you know, this could go a bit weird. And at one point, one of them asked me what I was doing, and I remember I had earbuds in, so I very slowly and as manly as I could took my earbuds out and kind of went, yeah, I'm just doing some cross stitch. And about 5 minutes later, I was kind of showing him the details of what we were doing, because it was like his mum used to do it and he was quite a fan. And I always think it's a bit surprising, isn't it? There's this like inherent cultural thing that almost like regardless of your gender, people have a familiarity with cross stitch. They know it's a friendly thing. They know it's a kind of safe thing. So it did kind of work in that favor. And I think like the gender discourse about stitching as woman's work is an interesting one. You know, I read The Subversive Stitch years ago, and I sort of see it as it was, you know, stitching was used as a tool to put women in their place so that men could be all magnificent and stuff. And obviously I'm being quite ironic there, but I think it's just funny that those stories have been so persistent. And so I'm quite conscious that as a man called Mr. X Stitch, I stand up and say I enjoy needlework, and I think everybody should try it for themselves to find out whether they fall in love with it. And I, you know, I don't really try and make myself out to be anything particularly special because I'm a man who does it. But at the same time, if that novelty factor wasn't there, I would have been able to achieve what I have done. And the novelty remains. You know, I picked up that cross stitch in 2003. So blooming heck, it's like been 20 years and people still think it's a novelty. Or, you know, when my wife has got a really good job, right? My wife works for the NHS. She's got a really good job. Everybody wants to find out about my job because I'm the guy who's got the cross stitch magazine. And that novelty persists. And although the times have definitely changed a lot, I guess it's still a story that's been told so much that people still think it's interesting, you know. And I've met a lot of men who stitch, and there are very many of us who don't really want to go, I'm a man who stitches. They just want to go, I'm a stitcher. But in the same way, I guess, as, I don't know, if you're a female blacksmith or any of those kind of, you know, the reverse, like gender construct in that kind of craft sector, it's still going to be the same thing. So I don't really go, I try not to make a big deal about being a man who stitches, but at the same time, I will defend stitching for men because I think men are afraid of that as an idea and we need to kind of get over it.
Yeah, no doubt. And that's the whole history of needlework in general is comical because it used to be exclusively men and you know, long ago, and then it goes to women. And yeah, I've just never been able to get over the self-consciousness of it outside of doing podcasts and doing needlework in the house here. It's I always struggle with it. So
Definitely, I mean, I suppose in some ways, so, you know, I've got tattoos, I've got a bald head, I've got a face only a mother could love. All of those things kind of work in my favor, but it's all like show business, you know, it's all like a little bit of a trick. Rosie Greer's Needlepoint of Men obviously is a prime example. And I really would love the opportunity to meet him before he dies. Cause he's like 90 now, isn't he? But even then, you know, his size and his persona was again a useful tool to just really challenge that concept of, like, you know, because I guess there's an assumption people make about men who stitch and men who work in textiles, and it couldn't be further from the truth, but it's all just bound up in that same story. Yeah. I used to, you know, I think because I've stitched on trains a lot and stitch on planes a lot, I've got to that point of knowing that the benefits outweigh the uncomfort, discomfort. So, for instance, I say to people, you know, if you're going on a long haul flight and you're doing stitching, regardless of your gender, make yourself known to the cabin crew, because then you're a little bit more interesting than the average. And I like to say that speeds up your gin and tonic return velocity. So they'll always want to come and see how you're getting on over the course of the flight, you know. So I think the benefits outweigh the pain, but I think the pain's a good thing to go through, in the same way as the pain of ballroom dancing for me was kind of worth it.
Kind of. I will say, the last time I flew to Europe, I stitched the entire way both ways, and you're right. Yeah, I had no trouble keeping a beverage fresh.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, and you end up talking. I did a flight back from America once, and the guy next to me was like Greek, and in the end, I think I let him have a go. I think because I'd got enough stitching in my pocket, in my bag or whatever, you know, I was sort of showing him how to do it, because we're on a 7-hour flight, and you can't ignore the big fella doing the stitching next to you for 7 hours, especially when he's going like, hey, look at my stitching.
Yeah, it's hard to ignore. Yep. Yeah. So how does the Mr. X Stitch operation come about? I mean, because you got a podcast, a magazine, a blog, all manner of things. What are the origins of that?
Yeah, so I've been stitching for a while. So I started off, I did the Kiss by Klimt, finished that, gave that to my mum. Then I think I did maybe another arty one, because that was all I was able to find at the time. I did a Geisha Girl. But somewhere down the line, I got a bit tired of doing designs that, well, I couldn't find anything that really reflected my taste. This was the thing, because although I'm a guy, I don't really want to do race cars, and I don't really want to do boats or pints of beer. And a lot of those cliches were the only things that were available. Then I discovered PC Stitch, which was software that meant I could make my own patterns. And that kind of unlocked quite a lot for me, because I like street art and stuff. So I would just find designs of other street artists and then turn those into cross stitch patterns and stitch them for myself, because that was a really pleasant thing to do. So I started doing that. And then I realized that actually it was, you know, by making patterns that catered to my taste, maybe there was a gap in the market. So I set up an Etsy store, and that was in 2008. And that was at the time when I came up with the name Mr. X Stitch. And I really wish, you know, like John Lennon in the Beatles or whatever, I really wish I could remember when I decided that the name Mr. X Stitch would come along. I might just pretend I did. I might just be like, I had a dream and there was a bright light and someone said, thou art Mr. X Stitch. But I can't remember what I chose the name, but I just sort of did.
Go with that. That'll sell.
Yeah, just edit that first bit out. Yeah, that'll be fine. So I started the Etsy store, and then I decided to do a blog to go behind the scenes and sort of explain, you know, for that added value for people. So that started in August 2008. And at first I'd write a bit about my life, but then I discovered the work of someone called Ulrika Erdis, because I was looking up for graffiti embroidery or graffiti cross stitch. And that was the person I found. And I was like, oh, this is interesting. So I blogged about her. And then I found someone called Francis Goodman, who did embroideries of the graffiti from toilets. And I was like, well, that's really weird. I like that. Let's
wait. Graffiti really from toilets?
Okay. Yeah, not the really bad stuff, you know, but just, hey. Okay, so I apologize for this. I always thought it'd be a really clever idea if inside toilets you wrote for a good time call and then put the number, but the number was for the local tourist information office. But I digress. I think that was the thing that was interesting. You've got this quite sordid scenario of writing that's written inside toilet cubicles, and then someone had hand embroidered that. And I was like, that's really interesting. So over time, I started to realize that there was lots of needlework out there, but you couldn't really find it. You know, there was a forum called Crafter. I guess Facebook was just starting. Twitter, you could talk to your friends on it. That was just becoming a thing. And so I just started finding other people's work and sort of sharing that. And over time, I kind of looked at how you could make a blog work, and I decided to set up columns for different subject matters. So we had, like, still going now, the Cutting and Stitching Edge, which is just like really contemporary stuff that I liked. We had Not Safe for Work Saturdays that featured like swearing and rude things in needlework. And then I managed to get other people to write columns for me. So we had Quilty Pleasures, which is about quilting, and Felter Skelter, which is about needle felting. And I sort of saw this space where I stopped at knitting because there was Ravelry and plenty of other sites there. And I didn't do anything to do with dressmaking, but I just saw all this other needlework where there wasn't really a website that was featuring that work. And so I just kind of went down that direction, really, and because I just saw stuff that I liked, whether it was plush toys or contemporary weaving or whatever, I just kind of like write blog posts about what I like doing. And then that just kind of carried on. So that blog still goes to this day, and I'm still trying to sort of, you know, feature new artists, and you can find us on Instagram and all those kind of things. But somewhere along the line, I think it was 2011, I decided to enter a needlework competition for a telly program over here called Kirsty's Handmade Britain. And that was, I entered a needlework competition, and I don't know if you guys have entered needlework competitions, but they're brutal. That's fair to say. So I did very badly because I didn't even know that, you know, your stitching had to be neat. I did a lovely design, right? It was Whitby Abbey at sunset. I stitched it on black fabric and I used photorealistic for the sunset. So it had loads of different colours in it. It looked really good, but the stitching was a bit ropey. I finished it at 2 o'clock of the morning of the show when I was in a Holiday Inn in Yorkshire, sellotaped it into the frame, stuck it up on the wall and hoped that it would do well. And it really didn't. But what happened was the host of the show, who's someone called Kirsty Allsop, she's quite well known over here, she was also taking part in the competition along with a bunch of other people, and she won the competition. Now, it was blind judged, so she won it fair and square. But one of the things was in the show was she was taught techniques along the way. So when it came out, everyone was like, well, of course Kirsty won it because she got all this help. And then there was a sort of sense of injustice on my behalf because I'd been like the interesting person with the interesting design. So by failing on telly, it kind of helped in a way because the nation fell in love with me. And by that, I mean like 400 people in the country. But but that then led to me obviously being a bit more well known as a stitcher. So I think then I curated a book called Push Stitchery, which is a gallery book about embroidery needlework. I started writing a column for Cross Stitcher magazine, maybe 2013, something like that. And all the while, I was kind of like seeing, you know, Instagram becoming a thing, understanding the way trends are moving, seeing Etsy continue to grow and seeing like this diverse range of designs coming out. Because like Julie Jackson's Subversive Cross Stitch in 2006 had like unlocked a lot for people. Suddenly it was all right to be sassy in your stitching. But there were lots of other styles coming in, and the relationship between cross stitch and pixel art was starting to form. And so I could just see these magazines that were just doing the same things. And forgive me for speaking frankly about this, but a lot of those magazines are still doing the same things. And they're not necessarily pushing forward on this diverse modern agenda to do with cross stitch. And it frustrated me because I was like, why don't you just let me guest edit an issue? Why don't you let me just, it gives them an opportunity to do things that are a bit different. But that never really happened. So then I was at a needlework show in 2016, I think it was, with Maria Diaz, who's a cross-stitch designer who's very well known. And I was sort of moaning to her about the general state of things. And she said, why don't you do your own magazine? And I was like, that's kind of interesting. Because it just so happened that I'd been a parish councillor from 2002 to 2008 and ended up doing the town council newsletter. So I'd learned how to do desktop publishing off the back of that. So I was like, oh, that could be an idea. And I sort of parked it and just, I knew how I wanted to make a magazine. I knew what I thought it should be, but I didn't really have the wherewithal. Then in 2017, I got one of those big planners that you get at the start of the year. And it was like, write down your big goals for this year. And I, as I've done in previous years, I wrote, become Mr. X Stitch full time. Just wrote that down there, didn't really give it any more thought. About 3 weeks later, got a letter of redundancy from my day job. And I was like, oh, okay. So I did a Kickstarter campaign to start my own magazine. And I set a goal of £6,000, I think. And I raised £14,000.
Oh.
And my wife was kind enough to let me take redundancy from the job. And so I launched X-Stitch then and just made the magazine that I wanted. And now it started off as a print magazine, but like print magazines, as I'm sure you're aware, real hard thing to be successful. And it's a really interesting sector, you know, but you print issues of a magazine. If you want them to go to shops, you have to give them at a discounted rate. You don't get that stock back. There's loads of just ways that it's really like an inefficient system. So at a certain point, I kind of pivoted to being a digital only magazine. And issue 25 came out 2 months ago. So, yeah, that's where I'm at with that. And the magazine is just, it's the kind of cross-stitch magazine that I want. We work with designers from around the world. I think I've got a list of think there's about 90 different designers that have worked in the magazine over the years from like 18 different countries. And yeah, fortunately, that's how I'm able to make a bit of a living now.
I bought the most recent one, the black one. Mm. Fascinating. I mean, you really, yeah, it is not your normal cross stitch at all. It's, I enjoyed it. It's very different. And I'm not sure I'd stitch any of that, but it's definitely different cross stitch. And I can see how you would easily find an audience that would just lap that up.
Yeah. Thanks. Yeah. I think the secret to me is that you've got all these different designers that are following their own creative paths. And it didn't make any sense for me to be the person at the center going, I want this particular type of pattern. So I decided right from the start that what I was going to do was offer up themes and then just invite people to respond to those themes within their own styles. And fortunately, you know, I try and have the themes being quite broad. So sometimes there are things like space and beats, but we've also had like the 1970s. We've had the munchies. You just have these different topics, and we've done cute things. We had a noir issue that was all kind of film noir, and I managed to even put a crime comic inside it. But all the while, I'm just discovering new designers and knowing what their styles are, and then thinking, well, actually, you know, if I'm going to have a certain theme, then I'll invite them to be a part of that. And what I do also, the last issue of each year is a mixtape. So with that, there isn't a particular theme. We just go, hit me with your best shots, quote Pat Benatar there, invite people to design, you know, things that they want. But it's also a great opportunity for people who've not really been in a magazine before to kind of come and have a go there. And so in a way, you know, it's the same as curating the Mr. X Stitch site. You know, my Instagram is filled with great work of other people, and I celebrate those people and try and provide an opportunity for them to shine and to reach a wider audience. And it's kind of the same with the magazine. So I just kind of like set up the shots and let the designers hit all the home runs.
Yeah, I'm sure that theme approach gives artists a chance to really stretch themselves too.
It's been really rewarding, honestly, because some of the designers, Maria Diaz, for instance, the one who got me in this mess in the first place, she's been a designer for like 30 years and does a lot of stuff. You know, lots of people love her work, but she has done some phenomenal designs for me because I kind of give her free range. A great example is the 1970s issue, where she did, what was it called? It's called Hanging by a Thread, and it was like an action movie poster that had a guy with a bald head and a beard, who might be a bit familiar, holding a gun. There was a car exploding in the background. There was like a kung fu woman, and it was just amazing. And I think that's the thing for a lot of them. They just get the freedom to really like splurge creatively in my direction. And for a lot of them as well, their aesthetics would never necessarily fit in with some of the more mainstream mags. So it just provides me that opportunity. And then, like I say, I work with designers from Poland, from the Ukraine, from Cyprus, from New Zealand. You know, I'm able to connect with designers from all these little pockets of the world because it's all kind of digital and it's really easy for me to kind of work with them.
Yeah. Yeah. And I can see why you got away from the print part. Yeah. In my day job, printing and postage, two biggest expenses. What a pain. Yeah.
I periodically do a flash sale that's called, there are cracks in my ceiling, can you help me sell magazines out of my loft, please? Because I've still got like many issues up there. But it's, you never really realize this, but you know, I don't know how it works in the States, but over here, if you want a magazine to be front and center in some of the like high street news agents, you have to pay a premium for that. So not only do you kind of have to sell the magazine at like 40% of the cover price, like I say, you don't get those magazines back. Then if you want them front and center, you have to pay a premium on top of that, let alone shipping the magazines to the place as well. So yeah. In the end, a magazine that might retail for £10, you probably make like maybe £3 out of that. And sometimes if the orders, you know, I never got to the scale where the orders would be sufficient to cover the production costs. So when it came to issue 5 of the magazine, I was staring at issue 6 and just thinking, if I do a print version of this, I'm going to go broke. I simply had to pivot it. But the beauty of that then is, you know, we live in a digital realm. I'm now able to do a magazine that has as many pages as I want. Each of the issues has the charts in two different formats. And because people are viewing them on tablets, they can kind of pinch and zoom and make them as big as they want. But it does mean, like I say, I can produce a 150-page magazine or a 200-page magazine, and there's no on costs, you know. So it provides a great deal of flexibility. Plus, we have like interactive links. So there's links to all the designers in the sidebar so people can connect with them. We have an interactive playlist. So each designer chooses a song that we put on a YouTube playlist. You know, there's loads of extra bits and pieces that you can add into the mix to just make it more fun for people. And I think it just works really well as being a tool for people who can try it now and you know, consume it however they want in whatever part of the world they are. You know, I don't have to, if someone buys it in New Zealand or on the other side of the world, it costs them zero shipping and right. takes zero time, you know. So I'm still quite analog, you know, I've got a record player, I still like print magazines and stuff, but I had to admit that it was a smart thing to do.
Yeah, and I have to applaud you. The color charts and then the option to have a black and white chart, because I prefer black and white charts. And that was a nice little extra thing in there that when I discovered that, it was like, oh, bravo. That's, yeah, well played.
Yeah, thanks. And it was sort of a bit of a no-brainer. I mean, the thing is now I'm trying to like retrofit the old issues to make sure that they've also got them in there as well. But, you know, you can also just do things like, I have this little thing where it says, do you want symbols on the chart near the front of the mag? And if you click that, it will just ping you over to the symbols version. I prefer symbols only as well, because I used to love getting a highlighter pen out and just, you know, coloring it in as I'm going. And I think it works with the Pattern Keeper app, I think, as well. I have a single page version of it that's designed to work with that. So, yeah, and that's the thing, you know, I could do another version of it if I wanted, or if I suddenly decide that I want to make it so that the charts are infinitely easier to read, I can make the magazine like 300-400 pages if I wanted to.
Yeah,
I mean, there's a sort of limit on the amount of file size and that kind of boring stuff. But I'm definitely happy with the way it's worked out, and I just continue to try and, you know, gain new readers and just engage with the community of stitchers. I love to feature the work of people that are stitching. We now have a thing called X Stitcher of the Month, even though it's quarterly magazine. But, you know, anybody who's in our Facebook group who's sharing their work, I'll try and sort of do an interview with them and just really show the different type of stitchers that are out there to complement the different type of designs that are available as well, to just, you know, just reinforce that thing that cross stitch is not what you think it was.
Right.
Yeah. And talk a little bit about the contemporary needlework competition. I was looking at that on your Facebook page, and it was like, these are very cool. This is a runner up.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
I'm going to do shout out to Marcia Young, Fiber Arts Magazine founder, because she was the one who put the idea in my head. She was giving me some of her wisdom. I just decided to do it. And it's been a really rewarding experience, because the thing was, I kind of did it. I kind of put it out there and I wasn't sure how it was going to be received and how it was going to work. But obviously, Mr. X Stitch, the website, has been around for 15 years now. And we featured, I think still now there's like 1800 blog posts. So there were lots of designers that we featured. And it was a funny thing to do, because I don't know, sometimes you do these things, don't you? And I do a lot of this work just in my office, in my house. And I'm just Jamie, just a guy in crews, got to go and do the school run in a little bit. And so it's hard to necessarily see your perspective, how other people may see you. But one thing I do know is, over the years, I've got to know a lot of cross stitchers, a lot of embroiderers and needlework artists. And so with the prize, I kind of just put it out there and just tried to share the word as best I could. And then also specifically target people who I'd known in the past and featured and invited them to take part. And in the end, for the first one, we had 160 entries from many different countries. I was also very fortunate to get, because it's a juried competition, so I was able to get four judges of very high caliber, and then me, just to round it out. But, you know, I had Angie Wyman, who's the degree course leader from the Royal School of Needlework. I had Alice Kettle, who's a renowned textile artist and a lecturer at Manchester Met University. I had my friend Dr. Jack Roberts, who's an art dealer and a machine embroidery artist. And then a friend of mine called Evan Preco, who's the editor of Juxtapose magazine. So I had these four different people who had, you know, different perspectives and were able to help make, you know, decisions and choose who were the artists that they preferred the most. And I just kind of let them, you know, choose the ones as they saw fit. And it was just fantastic. It was just great, because we had people who I knew, if you like, were amateurs who submitted their work anyway. And then we had people like Ollie Cogan, who've exhibited all over the place. You know, we had, you know, exhibited artists, amateurs, and kind of everything in between. And I didn't know who was going to win it. And it was just fantastic to see the people that did and to discover, you know, even like cross-stitch artists that I'd never seen before, and I thought I'd seen all of them. So it was just a really rewarding experience. And it was, yeah, I don't know. It was quite validating. I think that was the thing. I think from the Mr. X Stitch brand standpoint, if you like, it was just something where suddenly I was like, huh, I've done a kind of serious thing here, you know? And it was just, yeah, it was just a great experience, really.
Yeah. Now, I knew of you, poked around a little bit, but until I sat down to do research for this thing, I'd really not explored your giant website blog thing. And I was really amazed at the different types of needlework and related techniques that you cover. Did you start with cross stitch and then it just grew from there, or did you intend initially to cover as much as you could?
I think for me, it was always, I was just going to do, well, I started with the cross stitch because obviously that was like my wheelhouse, but then I just noticed other embroideries that I liked, whether it was art quilts from someone like Luke Haynes, or whether it was installation pieces by Joetta Maui, or very just, I just saw stuff that I liked. And the thing is I never did art at school. So my dad was a teacher at my high school, if you like, and the art teacher at my high school used to tell me how she used to bounce me on her knee when I was a baby, and that was sufficient to put me off doing any proper art education whatsoever. So, you know, I had all kinds of rubbishy jobs, if you like, but when I started seeing this work, I didn't have an art history background to consider. You know, I was just like, oh, I like that thing. That thing's made me laugh, and just quite naively wandering into it. So in a way, I just kind of like, I would just see work that I liked, whether it was on Etsy or Craftster or popping up on Twitter. And so I suppose I just kind of wandered into it. But like I say, over time, I was able to connect with some people who were like Zoe Williams, who is a needle felting artist. I managed to convince her to write blog posts for me for a while. Absolutely free. She did it because she loves needle felting. But it just meant that we had a lot more resource to do with needle felting there. And it was the same for what I would do a lot of the time is I would come up with a funny pun and then try and get someone to kind of write a blog about it. So one of my favorite titles was Adventures in Time and Lace, which was just about modern lace. But anytime we had like Quilty Pleasures, any of these things where it was like there was a technique, I would see whether there was a way to do a blog about it that would kind of fit in. You know, we had Gear Threads about machine embroidery, and then we also had Ghost in the Embroidery Machine, which is about digitized embroidery. And then we would have there was one called Textile Encounters, which is done by Ansi van der Vault, and that was like global textiles. I was just really lucky, I think, to find people who had a passion about it, who for some reason thought my website was doing a good thing, and so would work pro bono for me for quite a long time, just sharing the stuff that they loved. So I've built up this really big resource, and the challenge for me in many ways now is to still make sure that it's relevant for people and to make sure that people can still connect with that, because there's so much inspiration there that I want people to find. But you know, the way the internet moves and changes, and the way Google thinks things are important, then it doesn't. It's like a constant battle to reconfigure that content. You know, we used to have a thing called a stitchgasm, right? Which is where you see a piece of embroidery and you have a bit of a physical response to it. And we would do these posts and they'd just be like, look at this funny thing. Look at this Simpsons needlework or whatever. And that would be it. It would just be like a quick 30-second in and out. Thank you very much. But Google looks at those things now and think that people don't find what they want on those web pages because they look at them and then disappear quite quickly. So when those things change, it has this big effect on this behemoth of a website that I've got with all this content on it. So now I'm always just trying to find ways of like bringing the content back, you know, searching around for an article from 2009 and just updating the content and checking that the artist's still doing it. And sometimes it's really rewarding, honestly, because you see some people who I featured in like 2011, and I'll come back and see their work, and their creative path has just gone on a completely amazing journey. And it's brilliant to kind of see that. I almost feel like some strange, proud parent. But because I've been around for this length of time now, you know, I see all these different artists, and then, you know, finding new people on Instagram, all of that kind of stuff. It just keeps rolling. And I just feel, again, all I'm really doing is just featuring other people's work. But as I said earlier, I just have these cutoff points where I go, I don't really bother with dressmaking and I don't really do knitting, crocheting, any of those kind of things. But if it's contemporary needlework, including like millinery and plush toys and that kind of stuff, then we'll have a go at it, because I just felt that it was kind of being underserved elsewhere, really.
Yeah. Yeah. When we first started this one, we intended for knitting to be part of the deal and found out quite quickly that that is a fortress that, yeah, we just never mind.
I thought about setting up a social network to compete with the knitting one, and I was going to call it Rivalry, but I felt like that
there
was
you go.
An aggressive title.
Yeah. No, that is a beast of a thing, and we just decided early on, never mind. Rivalry, good.
Yeah. And when I started doing research with you, I was looking at all these different sites you had, and I was like, wait, I'm not researching Jamie. I'm researching who he's put on this blog and reading this information. It's like, okay, I got to go back up, because you have so much fantastic information there for someone who wants to be creative, wants to try a new technique or see an old technique used in a different way. The one that really fascinated me was the one on punch needlework. I've never been interested in doing punch work. It's like, okay, that's nice. You know, they have all these prim things, and I don't remember the artist's name, but looking at that and saying, oh my, she's doing portraits with the punch
Delaney
needle.
Connor. Yeah.
That was phenomenal. And it's great that you're putting those artists forward.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. I think in a way it was quite a relief. I can't remember when it was, maybe like 2010, when I sort of realized that the Mr. X Stitch website is basically nothing to do with me, because, you know, the irony with my life really is I don't have any time to do any needlework. So I feel insecure as a cross stitch designer because I work with such brilliant cross stitch designers. And then I don't have the time to learn the skills to deliver in any of the other things. And I've tried quite a lot of things, you know. I'll have a go at a bit of gold work. I'd love to do some silk, you know, like Japanese embroidery, some really fine stuff, but I just don't have the time. And that's partly being a dad of two young kids as well as everything else. But the beauty of it is I provide a platform to just showcase other people's work. And I think that thing of me being a novelty, me being a guy who stitches, there've been plenty of times when I've gone into schools and because I've gone, my name's Jamie, I'm a needleworker, I sort of suspend people's disbelief just in that one moment. And then that opens an opportunity to have a conversation about contemporary textile art and to show people modern lace and to show them all these techniques, which have kind of either manufacturing has kind of made them a bit irrelevant with things like, you know, lace and stuff like that, or people just don't know what they don't know. So, you know, mixed media, you know, hand embroidered portraits, like you say, punch needle, tufted rugs, all of those kind of things. There are people that are doing sublime work, and I just kind of hunt them down and feature their work, you know, and just try and celebrate them in the same way as other kind of contemporary art blogs would do. And it's all the while, it's just saying, you know, this stuff's amazing, you should pay attention to it. In a way, I'm quite glad that the world thinks that cross stitch is still for little old ladies and that needlework's still a bit kind of bland, because it means it's like mine for the taking, if you like. You know, it's there's so much out there that when the world eventually comes around to realizing it, it's going to be amazing. And I'll just go, well, here you go, 20 years worth of stuff. You know, come and have a look, you know. Yeah. In a way, that's where the kind of the podcast has come out of the back of that as well, you know, because now I'm just like, well, I'll just start having conversations with people about it as well, because it might be that people don't necessarily, you know, textile art and needlework, as you guys will appreciate, still isn't mainstream, but there's such a core of people that are interested in it that you go, well, I'll just serve those people as best I can. And then hopefully the rest of the world will cotton on at some point.
Right. Do you find that the lines of demarcation between the various techniques are getting blurred more and more?
Do you mean
like, you know, cross stitch and needlepoint and beadwork, and that we're seeing people mix things together to get to express what they want in their art?
What I have observed is that Instagram for better or worse, has led to an acceleration of creativity, you know, because it's never been simpler for people to showcase their work, and it's never been simpler for people to be inspired by other people. So I think there is, I guess, back in the day when these things were taught in schools and, you know, were passed down through generations, then it would be kind of, this is the way you have to do things. You know, the back of your work needs to be tidy. You should always, like, you know, stitch under certain circumstances. And I guess in the same way as a lot of open-minded people now aren't as fixed in their thoughts about identity or whatever, then needlework has kind of gone down that same route again. And it is kind of evolving, isn't it? You know, you've, one area that fascinates me that we don't really see a lot of yet is still this sort of wearable technology space, you know, people using soft circuitry and that kind of thing, you know, embroidery. I always remember there was an artist called Adriana Pace, and she did a series of pieces where she'd stitched lines of poetry, but she'd used a conductive thread. And if you put your finger near the poetry, your electromagnetic field closed the circuit, which would then play an MP3 of the rest of that poem. like there are areas like that that are really kind of ripe for the opportunity. And then I just think, you know, I'm still amazed that there are people who are doing cross stitch that I've never seen before in new ways. And the overlaps are really starting to take off. And I just think, there'll be the people that respect the traditional techniques. And I think that's really important, because we have this like historic artifact, you know, needlework is tangible and is a really tangible memory of life for people. But the new versions of these things provide that kind of excitement. Another example that springs to mind, and ring a bell when you want me to stop talking, is a guy called Faig Ahmed, who's an Azerbaijani weaver. So, you know, he weaves these rugs based on the Azerbaijani tradition. But when I first saw his work, he was doing things like putting pixels in them or putting graffiti. So you'd have like this traditional Azerbaijani pattern with graffiti through it, or glitches. And then he's moved into kind of 3D sculptural versions of these things. And it's almost like he's taken these traditions and putting them in a futurism context, which makes them exciting and relevant, and at the same time still traditional. And I think those are the things that are interesting. You know, every time someone pushes at a boundary and goes in a different direction, eventually that will resonate back and give the originating point a bit more value as well, because we have those connections. And, you know, needlework is part of our culture. It's definitely part of American culture, and it's part of the UK culture for a very long time as well. So, you know, I've always maintained, you know, if someone wants to do a sweary cross stitch, it opens a door that connects them to all of this, and they become part of a long history and needlework tradition. But it also means they can find their own way within that space, and maybe they'll come back and do things that are a bit more traditional, or maybe they'll continue to push in new directions. But it's just, it's continuing the flow of that river that's been going on for like millennia, really.
Yeah. Well, and that's, to me, there's kind of a push-pull in that there is a significant importance in retaining and keeping alive the original techniques and the original way of doing them. I mean, and you guys in the UK, I mean, so much history, and with the Royal School, I mean, all, you know, that it very much keeps techniques alive, but it's fun at the same time to see people go beyond, you know, doing traditional weaving and then, yeah, putting some graffiti in and just stretching the boundaries, because why not?
Yeah. And I love it. And I love when you get those, there's a girl called Charlotte Bailey, and she doesn't really do stitching anymore, but she was a Royal School of Needlework graduate, and she did a series of pieces that subverted chocolate bar logos here in the UK. So one would be like Cadbury's, and instead it said calories. And we had another thing called a lion bar, and she called it a liar bar, because she was kind of touching on the subject of eating disorders. But the thing I love, and I've said this before, is if someone doesn't like the content of the work that you're doing, so if I do some cross stitch and people don't like the content of it or the subject matter, they can criticize the form, because they can go, oh, it's cross stitch, it's not very good, you know, and use that as an excuse. Where someone like Charlotte's work, she trained at the Royal School of Needlework. She was using like A grade gold work to do this work. And so you couldn't fault the technique. And so that made it really interesting, because then if the content made you uncomfortable, you have to own up to that, because you can't fob off on the quality of the work. And I think that's where it's interesting, you know, as people start out stitching wherever they come from, the more time you spend honing your craft, the more you're going to want to understand the specifics of these techniques. And so I do think that, you know, it's rare to see someone who's still doing the same kind of thing 15 years down the road. You know, you do find a lot of people, I think, improve their skill sets. And that's where places like the Royal School of Needlework and some of the other established schools, and even just like, you know, established colleges and family traditions, you know, those things have a lot, like a strong part to play. And I think they will kind of continue to do so.
And I think having the base gives you a place to jump off from. It gives you, you know, to express your own story. Because, you know, all the things you shared, it's really people telling their own life story. I often think there was someone who was in an estate asylum here in the United States, and she wrote with a thread her story in her jacket. That's all she had. And her story is like stitched into her jacket. Yeah. And that's, people are just doing that. They're just telling their story, their own story, in their own way through their needlework.
I always love the fact as well, though, because we have this inherent understanding about needlework and this inherent cultural affection for it, that when you get someone who does spend 100 hours doing a portrait of a loved one, or someone who does, you know, make a really strong political point, it just has that extra impact. Mm-hmm. But I think that, you know, I remember Susie Vickery is another great artist who does all kind of mixed media work, but she did a series of iconic portraits. Now, I think she lived in Mumbai for a while, and she did portraits of like the wife of a taxi driver or the guy that does the laundry, these people who within that cultural setting had no value. And she made these portraits where they looked like gods and goddesses. And it was such an amazing way to kind of honor people. And it, again, because it's in that textile context, it just has an extra value as well. And I think that, you know, I say that even at cross-stitch classes, you know, if you've got a friend who makes the same snorting noise when they laugh or always says the same phrase or whatever, and you immortalize that for them, like, those are the kind of gifts that people will never want to give up. And there's the profoundness of it. It never fails to amaze me. I think that's what I love. You know, I started out thinking it'd be funny to do some cross-stitch, but, you know, I've seen so many pieces of work that have taken my breath away, and been able to share that work with other people. Like, it's just, I couldn't think of a better position to be in, you know?
Yeah. Do you find when you're doing your podcast, talking to artists, for me, one of the things that I take out of it week after week after week of interviewing artists is, it's just amazing to me, the artist's mind and how it works and how these ideas just come to the forefront. And some people have so many ideas, they don't have enough time to get them written down. I think that is the most fun, learning what the people do and how they got to it and all that is interesting, but it's the mind that is just so fascinating to me, because it's so different from others. I'm not gonna single out a type of person, but it's just such a different approach to life, and I love talking to people about it.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's always fascinating to me, from my own personal experience and from talking to other people, how you can be working on a project, and somewhere in the back of your mind, another idea just sort of creeps around the corner. And I've spoken to enough artists about that. Like, I'm the same as you. You know, if I'm talking to somebody, I'm always interested in their process and where they get their ideas from, and whether they work, you know, singularly, do one piece and then do the next piece. Or I've got a show coming out soon with a lady called Sally Wilson, and she trained in sculpture. She used to be an art lecturer. Then she had a car accident and got a head injury that had quite a profound effect on her, but she was still able to continue making art. And, you know, that was like 15 years ago, so she still produces this art, but actually she produces like 15 things at the same time, and some of them inform other pieces, and sometimes she destroys work because she's making other work out of it. And that version of events, which is far more like chaotic, if you like, less linear, is equally fascinating because there are all these things going on at once. And yet you do get those people who'll be like, I'll just do this piece, and then when that's finished, I'll do the next piece. And I think you just find that people just have to trust in that process. I think the slowness of stitch, the process of making textile art, allows that opportunity for reflection and for those ideas to come through. But it is always interesting, you know, I think as well about people who do portraits and they take a long time, and whether it's an imaginary character or the portrait of a person, like the amount of time they must spend reflecting on that to build a relationship with the subject matter that they're making as well. That always fascinates me.
Do you feel that needlework is gaining its place in the art world and as art, along with painting and sculpture and illustration? Are you seeing that in your end of the world?
It bugs me. It bugs me because it's, I don't think it is, you know. It bugs me because you only see, like, the only artists that are big time, like big time, that are doing textile art are people who are artists who've chosen to do textile art. So you get like Tracy Emin, who does quilts. Grayson Perry's another one over here whose tapestries, you know, are quite a piece of his work. But it always feels like people would become famous artists and then choose to do textiles. I do feel that this connection between men and art and women and craft slash hobbies is perpetuated through the art world, and it frustrates me. And at the same time, I'm like, well, you know, one day that tide's going to turn and I'll have like a body of like galleries, you know. Obviously I'll be a gallery enterprise by then. But I find it, I just think it's bizarre because I do think there's that gatekeeping thing. You know, I it's another conversation that I have with people on the podcast and just other artists I know, because they want to be respected as artists, but they get labeled as textile artists. And so you don't get someone who's like, Damien Hirst doesn't get called a paint artist necessarily. You know, there are certain medium, like you can duct tape a banana to a wall and charge £100,000 for it. But you know, you can't like weave a picture. Like there's, I don't know, what's her name? Oh no, it's gone. It's just frustrating that I think that for some reason the art establishment, I mean, when you get stuff that's really kind of edgy and exciting, then I think that kind of turns people's heads a little bit. And I know plenty of artists who've produced work and been able to somewhat use the novelty factor, and that's not to undermine their work whatsoever, but for instance, a good example is Ben Venom, who makes quilts out of heavy metal t-shirts. So he's taking quilting and sort of saying, you know, this is what people think of quilting, but because he uses like Iron Maiden t-shirts, it's that real juxtapose. It's the same thing that I've done, you know. It's, and that shock value again dispels people's conceptions and him an extra edge, which I think makes it more palatable for people who might be otherwise versed in more traditional crafts. And again, that's not like his work's brilliant. I'm not demeaning his work whatsoever, but I sometimes think you still need that novelty in order for it to gain mainstream traction. Whereas for a lot of people in a lot of other medium, whether it's street art or sculpture, it's easier for those guys to get it. You know, you go to craft fairs and, you know, you either get the craft fair that's got the letter Y in it, where it's someone making their own things out of like applique, you know, like an apron or whatever. Or you go to a craft fair where there's some aloof piece of sculpture that's like £100,000. And it feels like those two worlds can never like coexist. But it's that same like status driven, value driven, gallery driven kind of setup. I mean, I feel like it'll all fall down at some point, but I mean, I don't know. Is that similar to your opinion?
Yeah. Yeah. And that word craft is, that's the one that rubs me the wrong way, because we talked about this in a show some time ago, and I hate that word craft because it has that connotation of, you know, glue and paper on the kitchen table. And then someone pointed out, well, to them, craft means a craftsman, an expert. And I wish it always meant that, but it simply doesn't. And, you know, so a craft fair, like you say, you know, there can be two extremes to that. And but then needlework keeps, in textile art in general, keeps getting caught up in the cut it out with scissors and glue it down end of things. And it's just frustrating because there's, you know, and you shouldn't have to do shocking art with textiles to be claimed, you know, to be labeled as art. I mean, it's just another medium, and it's just frustrating.
Yeah. I mean, one of the projects I've got in the back of my mind, which I've taken like one step forward on, but I've got like 10 million projects on, but I'd really like to open an art gallery, and I'd like it to have a focus on textile and needlework, because I'm pretty sure I could create a world-class textile art gallery just from people that I know and show work that will blow people's minds. And I think that a lot of spaces just aren't willing to do that, whether it's because of rents or, you know, whatever circumstances, whether they don't see that there's a market there. But I just feel like I want to stand up and I just want to create a space, put that work in there, and just continually hammer the point home. Because like you say, it should just be art. It shouldn't need to have shock value. It should be whimsical. It should be beautiful. It should be poignant. You know, there are so many people making so much work that will just make you cry. And I think that that stuff should be shown in art galleries, but it does kind of get marginalized. And to the point about craft, that whole conversation is a really interesting thing. And I was having a conversation with like the co-host of my other podcast, The Lovecraft Show. And we were talking about craft. And the thing is, to me, it's like, crafting is just paying attention to a process. So I was saying, you know, if you're a gardener, you're a crafter. You know, if you're deadheading roses, you are performing a craft. And so I think what happens is the word craft, the verb of crafting, gets applied to like certain medium or media. And I remember listening to a lecture once where someone was talking about art and craft and design, and he was saying that it's almost like going white eggs versus blue eggs versus brown eggs. It's like they're all eggs, and all they're trying to do is go, these are different because they're different colors.
Yeah.
Whereas my thesis is, if you carry out, you know, if you get a cross stitch kit and you just do it and you enjoy it, then you've done a hobby, fantastic. If you get a cross stitch kit and you pay attention to how the stitches are, and maybe you get a laying tool so you can railroad the stitches and you make sure it's finished nicely, then perhaps you become a craftsperson because you're taking care with it. If you take the cross stitch pattern and you subvert it and you put your own spin on it, and maybe you change the colors, or maybe you just write some text over the top of it, whatever, then you become an artist because it's your own expression. And that's how I see that trifecta. And it doesn't matter what medium it is, because the medium is just a perpetuation of like a value driven system, you know, that says that painted spots on a wall are worth £100,000. But actually, it's the expression that's the key. That's the art. And it doesn't matter whether you do it in like corn doily weaving or making a dinosaur out of car parts.
Yeah, so true. Okay, got to convince everybody else, though.
Just send them my way. I'll convince them.
All right, Jamie, thanks so much. Fascinating stuff. And what you've built is quite impressive. Congratulations on that.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate it. It's a funny one because you don't see what you've done. You know, I just see all the fires I've got to fight and the next thing I've got to do and the next thing I've got to do. But I feel very honored to have gone, oh, look at that, a cross-stitch kit. I bet that'll be funny. To now, you know, having a needlework prize and being able to be an advocate for the world of textiles and to have conversations with people like yourselves. You know, I could talk about this stuff all day, and I just feel very grateful to have gotten to a point where I kind of get to do this for a living. Because I can't, like, I will stop talking, but I remember once going to the Ashmolean Museum in Oxford, and I was staring at some Chinese textiles that were like from like, I don't know, 500 BC or 500 AD or something, and just going, oh my God, I've wandered into a socio-political discourse that's been going on for millennia. And I was like, why didn't I do a blog about Lego? That would have been a lot simpler. So I just feel like, you know, we're in this amazing place, aren't we? We love needlework, and needlework, since a man in a cave sewed two pieces of moss together, like, needlework's been a thing. And so, you know, the fact that I can show off people's work and continue to do that is something that I'll always be grateful for.
Yeah. Well, it's terrific stuff. Thanks for sharing it. And thanks to everyone for listening.